May it please the court, I'm Robert Dodd with the Colorado Attorney General's Office, and I represent the Colorado Department of Revenue in this case. The question here is whether the state is required to pay DP $1,300,000 in tax plus 10 years of interest to compensate the company for the theoretical return on investment, as they would call it, representing the amount that the company might have made had it invested in something, in some other investment rather than the actual gas transportation facilities at issue in this case. BP contends that this is a cost that is deductible for severance tax purposes from what is defined as gross income under the statute of issue section 102.3a. The agency and the district court below reached opposite conclusions about this question. The department contends on appeal that the district court, in reversing the agency, committed at least three errors. First, the district court incorrectly found no ambiguity in the statutory term cost of transportation, or cost borne by the taxpayer. Second, the district court misconstrued the law and the legislative history. And third, the court failed to give appropriate deference to the administrative agency charged with implementing the statute, and which has expertise in this area.
Counsel, let me just ask you to kind of frame where your argument may be going a little bit. So you articulated three contentions. Do the second and third contentions, are they dependent on our agreeing with your position that there is an ambiguity in the statutes?
Thank you, Your Honor. In a sense, they do depend on that, because if the court were to conclude that there is no ambiguity, in other words, if there's no other way to read the statute, there's only one way it can possibly logically be read. And of course, that's the interpretation you have to give in the questions of legislative history and deference to a reasonable agency interpretation. Those would fall away.
And so, and my understanding is you are not contending that this statute is unambiguous the way you want it to be read. Your contention, it is ambiguous, and therefore we should look at these other issues as well.
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct.
Thank you.
We do contend that that's exactly right, that the statutory deduction for cost of transportation is an ambiguous statutory term. Generally, a statute is ambiguous if it is susceptible to differing but rational interpretations. Here, the term costs, or in fact, several variations thereof, have been held to be ambiguous by Colorado courts. The department cited, I believe, seven or eight cases in which various terms of cost have been so construed. For instance, in one case, the cost of development was at issue. Another was seller's cost. Another case construed actual costs. Another was cost of milling. Yet another was cost plus. In each of those cases, the terms were found to be ambiguous.
How many of those cases were tax cases?
Your Honor,
and does that matter?
Problem I have, I don't believe I could give an accurate response on how many were actually tax cases, but for instance, the Fidelity Castle Pines case, that was as a tax case, but it was a property tax case. So we don't necessarily think that for all purposes you can apply property tax law, and that's one of the arguments that is at issue in this case, to severance tax. But in generally speaking, the term cost has been found ambiguous, and in a tax situation, in the Fidelity Castle Pines case, for instance, and as to your question, does it matter? Each case might logically need to be reviewed on its own merits, but in full and as a general rule, We think the law has been consistent in finding across the board in different contexts that the term cost is ambiguous, and BP has cited no authority to the contrary, which is, I think, telling in itself. Now, BP has cited a case that the department's also cited. I guess one point of agreement is we both believe the case, which is the Atlantic Richfield 10th Circuit case, both parties believe that that's a relevant decision. What we don't agree on is what it means. But in that case, the court reviewed Colorado law and concluded that, to quote, several permutations of the word cost have been deemed ambiguous by Colorado courts. And as a result, the court ordered a remand. That was a private royalty agreement. This court construed two lease agreements, private contracts involving royalties. So as a result, the court ordered a remand to the district court to determine the intent of the parties in concerning what was meant by the term cost of transportation. And as to whether, and particularly, whether the cost of capital was included. Cost of capital is an alternative term the parties have used here to describe return on investment, which is a deduction that's being sought. So in the Atlantic Richfield case, the court specifically concluded that whether the term cost of transportation in the lease agreement included the cost of capital was unclear, and it ordered a remand. I think the particular language that's relevant there, and I'll quote at page 1152 of that decision, the court stated that whether it uses a couple of acronyms, IDC and COC, which are interest rate construction and cost of capital. So it said whether IDC and COC are deductible transportation expenses depends in part on the language of the parties' lease contracts. And so according to the first test is to determine whether the phrase cost of transporting includes cost of capital. Now, the court said, and this is a quote, the phrase, quote unquote, cost of transporting, close quote, is decidedly ambiguous as to whether it included those items. And that is in particular what they're claiming in this case, is they want the cost of capital as a deduction. So in that case, which we both contend is relevant, we argue that the rule is cost of transporting is ambiguous as to whether it could include return on investment or cost of capital. Now there's an important difference between the situation in Atlantic Richfield and the one in this case, because in a private contract matter, when a lease agreement or contract is found to be ambiguous in some respect, as the Tenth Circuit did, the remedy is remand to determine what the parties intended. But in a statutory construction case involving a deduction, there's a different remedy, because we don't remand for the party's intention. We have a rule of construction that applies, particularly in this case where you have a deduction, and that is that an ambiguous deduction must be construed in favor of the public interest and against the taxpayer's private interest. And the rationale is pretty straightforward. If we're going to be giving away state money based on a deduction here, we're talking about a couple million dollars.
Well, let me ask you a question about that a little bit, because you can kind of take the rule of construction. Some of them are at odds with each other, and some of them don't come out the same way. So you're saying if it's ambiguous, am I hearing you say that the state always wins? What if you looked at legislative history and it was clear that the legislative intent was to favor the taxpayer here? Which of those two rules of construction would win?
If there were conflicting rules of construction, I think the order of preference would probably be applied based on which is the most clearly applicable under these circumstances. I mean, looking at the legislative history, if that absolutely cleared something up, then you probably have a resolution of the ambiguity so that you don't need to apply a rule of statutory construction further that resolves the doubt in favor of the taxing authority and against the taxpayer. But, Your Honor, I would disagree with the notion that we have, I'm not sure if this is what was intended, that we have conflicting rules about whether deductions and exemptions are construed against the taxpayer in favor of the government. That is very clear. The numerous cases cited from Indopco to Calvin, U.S. and Tenth Circuit, Robinson and Theobald in state courts. So it's a very clear rule, and we think that the district court's first mistake was in not finding the ambiguity where it's a clearly ambiguous term has been held to be so, and second, not applying those rules. The district court, I have a few minutes left. I want to make additional point and reserve some time. The district court also misconstrued the legislative history in this case, and that led to an error in the court basically imputing a regulation from the property tax administrator, which is a completely different agency administering a different tax, into the realm of severance tax, which is administered by the Department of Revenue. What the court said was that it was logical to believe that the legislators would have wanted to construe the statutes in similar fashion, and that based on that property tax regulation, which allows return on investment, that it should be allowed here. But in fact, at the time of the amendments to the statute that were under consideration, and during the relevant period for legislative history, neither agency allowed return on investment. So the reasonable interpretation would be that it also would expect revenue would not allow it. But the basic rule is, and BPP has not cited a single jurisdiction to the contrary, that ROI is only allowed, or return on investment as a deduction, is only allowed where it's specifically so stated. BP has offered no authority that would hold otherwise, and it's offered no state that would allow such a deduction without a specific authorization. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for a while.
Thank you, Mr. Dodd. You've got about 2 minutes and 45 seconds.
Good afternoon. My name is Alan Poe. I'm with me is Rachel Poe of the Poe Law Office, LLC. We're appearing on behalf of the Appalachian BP America Production Company. My registration number is 7641. May it please the court. The Colorado Severance Tax statute that we're dealing with in this case, specifically section 3929.1023A, defines the taxable base for the severance tax. And it defines it as, quote, gross lease revenues less deductions for any transportation, manufacturing, and processing costs borne by the taxpayer, end quote. That language is very broad, and it provides for deductions for any transportation, manufacturing, and processing costs borne by the taxpayer. Despite that, the Department of Revenue has denied BP a deduction for the cost of capital that BP and its predecessors invested in what are acknowledged to be transportation and processing facilities that are used to transport and process natural gas that BP produces from coal seam gas wells in southwest Colorado. The district court held that the department's denial of the deduction for cost of capital is contrary to the unambiguous statutory language. That holding is correct, and as you indicated, that resolves the case, and I think the department has acknowledged that if, in fact, the statutory language is unambiguous, that resolves the case and that the district court decision should be affirmed.
So can you address specifically what I perceive to be the main argument by the state, which is the statute may use the word any, but their view is the word cost is ambiguous.
Absolutely, and let me begin by explaining what cost of capital is, because I think the state misunderstands or at least misstates the meaning. They use the term return on investment. Return on investment is one potential measure of cost of capital, but But by using that term, I think they have frankly confused themselves a little bit and misapplied the law.
But it is correct that it's return on investment that is at issue in this case. I mean, we're not misstating it if we refer to it as return on investment.
The state says that they're synonyms, and so we'll accept that notion. But it's important to understand what we're dealing with, not just the terminology. Cost of capital, in this case, BP and its predecessors invested hundreds of millions of dollars in transportation facilities and in processing facilities in order to transport and process the coal seam gas that was produced in Southwest Colorado. Without that investment, the coal seam gas couldn't be produced and sold, and the state would receive no severance tax at all from that gas. That investment is clearly a transportation processing cost, the actual investment itself. And the state doesn't disagree with that. In other words, the money that was spent to build these facilities, the state agrees that is a cost, that is an investment.
And that's why the basic depreciation is allowed here, is that
exactly
correct?
Exactly, and the state allows the depreciation deductions, but it doesn't allow that to be taken up front. In other words, even though the hundreds of millions of dollars were spent early on, the state requires that that cost be recovered over an extended period of time of many years. And as a result, while the money is spent up front, the deductions are not allowed until later, there's essentially a cost of carrying that investment until it is recouped for severance tax purposes through the depreciation deductions. In essence, if I gave someone $1 million, if I had it, and they paid me back $50,000 a year for 20 years, and that's all I ever received from them, I have borne a cost, the cost of having that money tied up or invested for the 20-year period before I get it back.
So I know that this is a subsidiary issue, but it is talked about in the briefs. Even assuming that we were to accept that, how in the world do you calculate that without running into speculation? I mean, what framework would you use to figure out what that return is?
Well, there are a variety of ways. Let me first say that in this case, perhaps in order to simplify the issues, the parties have stipulated to what the cost of capital deduction is. So I understand that the question about how do you figure it, that's not directly before the court here.
So there's no issue in terms of what the dollars are that we're talking about?
None whatsoever. And the state has specifically stipulated, and both parties have stipulated, that if cost of capital is allowable, then the refund the BP is entitled to is a certain amount, plus interest, and the state acknowledged both below and I think in the briefs here, but they're not disputing that. In fact, it's a bit of a red herring in the briefs where they argue, gee, it's really hard to calculate. I do have a response to that, though. But
I would like to hear that, because even though they're stipulated to the amounts, I think it's sort of relevant to our determination of what is a cost. Is this thing that we're talking about a cost?
Sure. And it certainly is a cost in any economic terms. I think, in fact, the Supreme Court in the case that was cited in the department's brief, the Fidelity Castle Pines case, the Supreme Court even said, I believe it was, the word was, I'm sorry, I'm looking for the quote. Oh, it's a payment received today is more valuable than a payment received in the future. In other words, there is a cost to getting back money over a period of time. It's an economic cost, it's a cost in any ordinary and common meaning of the word cost. The calculation is actually fairly straightforward. It's again, it's not necessarily the only calculation that could be prescribed, but the typical calculation, the one used by the property tax folks here in Colorado, who do allow cost of capital, the one used by the federal agencies that administer royalty under federal lease agreements, it is basically the undepreciated, in other words, the amount of the investment that hasn't yet been recovered at the beginning of the year, times a rate. And the typical rate that's used is BBB bond rate. That essentially reflects a cost of borrowing, or a cost of an opportunity cost, whatever you want to call it. It's basically a relatively straightforward rate. The calculation is actually pretty simple. The Department of Revenue has said, well, we haven't specified what our rate is. We haven't told you how to calculate this. Therefore, you can't take it. But the department has also not told taxpayers generally how to calculate depreciation. And yet, taxpayers do take depreciation. So the fact that the Department of Revenue has not specified here's how you do it doesn't answer the question of is this an allowable deduction? And as we said, it is a cost. It's recognized as a cost by the property tax folks. It's been recognized as a cost by the federal royalty folks, formerly the Minerals Management Service, now the Office of Natural Resources Revenue. The 10th Circuit Court of Appeals in the Atlantic Richfield case that I'd like to address briefly recognized it as a cost. And even the Department of Revenue, in its briefs in this court as well as in the final determination, repeatedly refers to it as an opportunity cost. They don't know how to describe it except as a cost. It is a real, actual cost. Since the statute clearly says any transportation, process, manufacturing, and processing costs borne by the taxpayer are deductible, the statute is unambiguous. If it's a cost, it's deductible. And that's what the district court held, and we believe that that is, in fact, the correct answer. I would like to address briefly the...
Before you leave that point, I have a question. In any event, even though the parties have agreed in this case on the amount of dollars involved, doesn't determination of opportunity cost, isn't that a hypothetical cost? Something that has yet to be expended in most cases?
Again, the department uses that term opportunity cost. Opportunity cost is one way of measuring the cost of capital, but it is not the cost that we are talking about here. The cost of capital would include, for example, it could refer to if you're borrowing money in with which to make an investment, it's what you're paying for interest. If you need to get equity investment from investors, it's what you have to assure them or indicate to them as a return for their money in order to get them to put it in. If you're using your own money, then yes, it may be sort of a foregone opportunity. But it goes back to what the Supreme Court said. A dollar received today is not as valuable as a dollar received in the future is not as valuable as a dollar received today.
But if that's the way to look at it, why do you get interest on top of that? Isn't this just interest on interest in a sense?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by getting interest, but you don't get interest on top of the cost of capital. The costs that the Department of Revenue allows does not include interest.
But I thought you said that it had been stipulated that when you get this amount back.
I'm sorry, I misunderstood the question. Certainly, BP has paid the money. BP has paid to the Department of Revenue the tax that is the result of this assessment. The department has had that money for the last 10 years.
Okay, so that's
BP exactly. Is simply saying, when we get that money back, we also, and in fact, that's a very good example of why cost of capital is a cost. The state charges you interest if you don't pay your taxes on time, and pays interest when it holds money that it's not entitled to. The state recognizes in that respect that yes, there is a cost of capital. Very briefly, there were the department said that it cited seven cases in which various permutations of the word cost were held to be ambiguous. Only one of those involved taxes. That was the Fidelity Castle Pines case. It was a property tax case. One of them was the Atlantic Richfield Company case that I'd like to briefly talk about. The other five were all contract cases. None of those cases dealt with the expression or the phrase any costs. They dealt with costs with other adjectives in front of them, milling costs, for example, costs of development, but none of them dealt with the phrase in this statute, any costs, any transportation, manufacturing, or processing costs borne by the taxpayer. Nor did any of them, except the Atlantic Richfield Company case, address cost of capital. And I want to note that with respect to the Atlantic Bridgefield Company case, there are actually two separate sets of contracts that were issued there. In one of those contracts, the parties had said costs of transporting gas would be deductible. And the Tenth Circuit said, well, we don't know whether that includes cost of capital or not. We need to send it back for the court to decide what did the parties mean by that. In the other one, though, and the one that we think is relevant here, the court said the lease itself says nothing about transportation costs. Therefore, as a matter of law, under Colorado law, under the Garmin case and the Rogers versus Westman, or Westman versus Rogers case, as a matter of law, reasonable transportation costs are deductible. That's a law in Colorado from the Colorado Supreme Court. In applying that law, the Tenth Circuit held as a matter of law that cost of capital was a reasonable transportation cost. So it didn't find the term transportation cost as used by the Supreme Court in the Garmin and Westman Farms case to be ambiguous at all. It said as a matter of law, cost of capital is a reasonable transportation cost. If it's a reasonable transportation cost in the Supreme Court's terminology, then it certainly is a part of any cost of transportation.
Mr. Pohl, I don't want to interrupt your train of thought of this particular argument, but I haven't heard your response to the last point the state made, that other states have who do apply your rule do so because their statute specifically mentions costs. Our statute doesn't. The legislature in I think it's Wyoming and Mexico have answered that question. Shouldn't the legislature in Colorado be asked to adopt that if that's what you want, instead of asking a court to do it by what would constitute judicial legislation?
I don't think it would constitute judicial legislation at all, Your Honor. I believe that, first of all, the statement that the department makes, I think, comes out of their expert's report, which we've said was really not part of the record here. And the statement of the expert's report was not that all states that allow it have it in their statute. It said, the expert's report actually said, there is no common usage where it doesn't say it, but it didn't say there's no consistent usage. But in answer to your question, I believe the legislature has answered the question. The legislature said any cost. The legislature could have said any out-of-pocket cost, any direct cost, any whatever they wanted to do. They said any cost. And I believe the legislature has answered that question, as does the property tax administrator, as we pointed out.
Thank you.
I apologize for taking too much time. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Dodd, you've got 2 minutes and 44 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. To address the court's last point, this would be, this is an effort by BP to obtain through litigation what it could not obtain or cannot obtain from the legislation directly or from a regulation that would allow this. BP has cited the question of, well, gosh, we get a depreciation and amortization, but without a rule, but why not this? Depreciation and amortization volumes have been written about. It's accepted in the GAAP, the generally accepted accounting principles are promulgated by the Financial Accounting Standards Board. There are more books to fill a room with. We have not cited a single instance of a jurisdiction allowing this hypothetical cost as a deduction in which it is not specifically granted. So to the court's question about the way it should be calculated, the department stipulated to the numbers because the numbers at issue here are the minor point in terms of what the measure is. But the fact that BP must, in order to claim this, reach out to a different agency's regulation, because first, the Department of Revenue doesn't allow it. Second, There's no measure provided. So they have to reach out and find some other agency's measure for this. That should tell us something about what they're claiming. And the bigger point is that this, if allowed, this will be a significant matter fiscally for the state. This case alone is a couple of million dollars, including interest, from 10 years ago, but we have open periods of statute, and it would apply to every oil and gas producer in the state of Colorado. It would be a massive amount of money. We don't even know how much, whether it's tens of millions or 100 million, we don't know. But if that much money is going to be taken from the people of Colorado and given to private companies as a deduction from severance tax, it ought to be plainly stated in law. Certainly, it is not here. Courts have found numerous times that various terms, including the word cost, are ambiguous. The fact that both the agency and then the district court each came to opposite conclusions should also tell us something about the ambiguity of the term. This is too thin a reed to make such a sweeping grant of a deduction in this case. We would ask the court to reverse the judgment of the district court and hold that this deduction is not available.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both the counsel for your arguments. The case will stand submitted. The division will issue an opinion in due course.